Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and apologies for the slight delay, but we've got a rather large in number panel at the head table to get organised and someone on the phone, so it's a little bit hectic to get everyone into their places, but I hope you all got a cup of tea and coffee and that you're all settled back for this next session, which is convened by our former Chief Executive Officer and the latest member of the former Leaders Advisory Group, now Leah, in the organisation. So Leah Van Poppel is with us today. So would you make Leah welcome?
Thank you for that introduction, John. Today we're going to be talking about government services in all their forms, some of the big changes. Thank you.
Middle mic.
Okay. We're going to be talking today about government services and some of the big changes that are happening for people with disability, and particularly people who are blind or vision impaired, across the spectrum. So we'll be talking about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, NDIS, something called Continuity of Support, and My Aged Care. And as John alluded to, we have a rather large panel here today. So what we're going to do is I'll just quickly introduce people, give them a further introduction as they each start to speak. And we're going to hold off on questions until the end. And we'll have a number that you can text if you have questions and you're listening in on the stream today. So that number is 0430 210980. I'll repeat that later. So on the panel today, we have Catherine McAlpine from the Australian Federation of Disability Organisations, Nadia Matiazzo from the City of Yarra. We have Peter Sumner, who's representing the voice of consumers in the My Aged Care system. We have Lauren Henley, who is currently from both BCA and the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. And on the phone, we will have Michael Simpson from Vision Australia. We're going to begin with Catherine McAlpine from AFDO. So Catherine is the Senior Manager of the Disability Loop Project at AFDO and comes to the sector with a wealth of experience, having previously been on the Victorian Disability Advisory Council and been the CEO of both Down Syndrome Victoria and Down Syndrome Australia. Catherine, over to you.
Thanks so much, Leah. Is that right?
Yep.
Thanks so much, Leah, for and thank you to John for inviting me today. It's a real pleasure to be here. So I'm talking about the introduction of the NDIS, and particularly in Victoria. So in trial, we had 30,000 people with disability were brought into the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and now we have moved to the period, the next three, that was the first year, 3 years, and that was 30,000 people. Now in the next 3 years, we're doing the transition to full scheme, and that means they're bringing in an extra 430,000 people. Now, in Victoria, and so that's about 14 times as many, so nationally they're moving from making about 800 to 900 access decisions a month to making about 12,000 access decisions a month. And so we have to understand that the transition is going to be different to what it will look like in so-called full scheme. Once we're all in, the way the scheme will develop from there will be slightly different to what happens over the next 3 years, where the priority is actually doing the transfer from state and territory systems to a national system. So I just said that was about 14 times as many, but in Victoria, our trial site at Barwon brought in 4,843 people, and it's expected by full scheme we'll have more than 105,000 people. That's actually more than 20 times the number. So as you can see, the processes that the government and that the NDIA have put in place are going to be different from what they were in trial, and in fact may well be different to what happens in full scheme, because they have to get us all across the systems. And so there are some differences that you'll find if you spoke to people who were involved in the Victorian trial. So what happens first, and that's a difference, is information gathering. So what happens is that the state government and the federal government made a bilateral agreement, and in that agreement they agreed which areas would come in first, and then within those areas which groups of people would come in first, and they organised the order of things. And in those agreements, you will already know that it was agreed that northeast Melbourne area would be the first area to go in full in the transition. So that's why there's this flurry of activity around the northeastern suburbs of Melbourne. And of course, then we're going to move to the other areas of Central Highlands and at the same time Central Highlands and Loddon. But for those of us that live in the metropolitan area, we hear more about northeast Melbourne area. So what happens to you as a person with disability on the ground in your transition to the NDIS? Well, the first thing that happens is information gathering. And what they're doing now is in that bilateral agreement, they agreed, which was different from trial, they've agreed for an exchange of information. So if you are already getting any services that are anyway funded by the Victorian state government, then you will automatically be contacted by the NDIA. But that first contact is likely to be by phone, and it's likely to be either from the National Access Team or it might be from another partner organisation who's an information gatherer. And they will ask you a whole lot of questions, and they will ask you questions to verify that the information they have is correct. And then they might ask you some other questions that are involved in the access process. So that's actually being eligible for the NDIS and going through the process of becoming an NDIS participant. So it's a bit disconcerting because people just get phoned up. What we have heard is that they usually just phone you out of the blue, but then they ask you to book a time with them and they say, okay, well, we'll ring you at 3 o'clock on Friday. And so far I've been told when they tell you that they're going to ring you at 3 o'clock on Friday, they ring you at exactly 3 o'clock on Friday, that system has worked okay. But people have found it fairly disconcerting doing quite a lot of that work on the phone. But if you think about it from the perspective of the CEO of the agency, if you've got to get all these people from one system to another system, what they, you know, it is, whether or not they say it or not, the reality is they're trying to minimise the amount of face-to-face contact to restrict the amount of face-to-face discussion to that information and that needs to be discussed face-to-face. So they're trying to get all the stuff that you don't necessarily need to do face-to-face, getting that done on the phone. And the other person that you probably will find yourself talking to is a local area coordinator. So you would have heard a lot about planners and you would have heard about meeting with planners, and not many people are going to meet with planners anymore. Most people are going to meet with local area coordinators. And that's because, again, they've to a certain extent split up the planner job, and about three quarters of the planner job, which is the discussions and the working out what you might want in your plan and the discussions about what you want from your life in the next 12 months and the long term, that discussion part of it will happen with local area coordinators. The actual approval of the plan still is done by the National Disability Insurance Agency internally. Now, these local area coordinators are not employed by the agency. They're actually employed by a partner organisation. And the NDIA has put out big tenders for organisations to apply to be those partner organisations. So quite a lot of you will have heard about the Brotherhood of St Lawrence. And the Brotherhood of St Lawrence is the partner organisation who employs the local area coordinators in the northeast Melbourne area. But there are two other organisations like BSL. Well, sorry, very acronymy in the sector. So BSL is Brotherhood of St Lawrence. There are another two organisations in the other two areas that have started. And they are La Trobe Health and InterReach. And so you'll find InterReach working in the Loddon area and La Trobe in the Central Highlands. So it's only if you're in metropolitan Melbourne you can get sucked into thinking that the Brotherhood of St Lawrence are the only game in town when it comes to local area coordinators. And I would say to you that if any of you have managed to open today's or look online to Today's Age, you'll see that there are ads out. They're employing more local area coordinators if anyone's looking for that type of job. And so they will be the people that you have your relationships with, and they are leading you through what's known as the first plan process. So you might have heard about the planning and assessment conversation, which was the number of conversations that people might have had with planners to get a plan set up. And that's been shortened considerably. And the local area coordinators have a conversation with you, which is a very structured conversation where they ask a whole lot of questions about your life to ascertain what might be in your first plan. And in that conversation, they really concentrate on two things. They concentrate on what's called core support. So they're supports you need all the time just to get out of bed, get organised, get to work, get to wherever you're going in your life, making sure that you're safe, making sure that you're healthy, making sure you can get in and out of bed, get to work, get to leisure, have your relationships. So they concentrate very much on core, and they concentrate on capital. So capital means anything that needs an investment. So, you know, that mainly means vehicle modifications or house modifications. What's lower down the priority list and has caused some angst is capacity building. So there's not as much emphasis on capacity building in the conversations. So that means, you know, maybe learning new skills, getting more work ready, things like that. So it's not impossible to get those things into your plan. So a lot of people think that you can't get capacity building in your plan anymore, but in fact you can. It's just that you only really have one conversation to have with the local area coordinator. So you need to be in a position to have thought about what things you might want in capacity building. And that might include help with planning. So some people, if any of you are on NDIS grassroots, you might have heard a few negative things about first plan. But one of the things when AFTO did a gap analysis about 18 months ago on this, one of the things we found is that people tended to just try and get their current supports in a first plan, and in their second plan really started to think about what a good life might look like. The other thing that the agency found is that people found the planning process very difficult, and of course you can't give people supports to help them plan if they don't already have a plan with money in it to provide those supports. And so one of the things you can get in your plan is help with future planning. So that's a capacity building thing you can ask for. And if you have capacity building in your plan, then, or helping planning in your plan, then you can get help to develop your first big plan, so to speak, which would be your second plan. And then the other thing they concentrate is unmet need. So unmet need is the things that you need that you haven't been getting now. So that's the important part there. The only final thing I was going to mention is that I said that nearly everyone would be dealing with a local area coordinator. What the NDIS do as far as those phone calls is they try and ascertain how much support you're going to need through the planning process. And if you need very little planning, they will designate you as a self-planning or if you've indicated you want to self-manage, and you will deal with a local area coordinator. About 70% of people will be identified as needing some level of support in their planning, in their access and to activate their plan, and they will get that support from a local area coordinator. The last 20 to 30%, and I know the numbers don't add up because they're ranges, will be people who are regarded as needing intensive supports. So if you have more complex situations in your life and you need more support, then you will be able to get support from a specialist NDIA planner that won't be the local area coordinator, will be a person employed by the agency themselves.
Thank you, Catherine. If we can just hold off on questions until the very end, we'll move on to our next speaker, who is going to be Nadia Mattiazzo. Nadia is currently the Metro Access and NDIS Implementation Officer at the City of Yarra. So her role includes supporting local residents into the NDIS and working with the NDIS, Brotherhood of St Lawrence, who we've just heard a bit about, and other agencies to make sure that the local community is as well prepared as possible. And she's going to talk a little bit about the NDIS from a local perspective in an area where it's rolling out. Thanks, Nadia.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks, John and Helen, for inviting me here. I'm really looking forward to speak to you about the rollout of the NDIS in the North East Melbourne area. Firstly, just by way of introduction, I'm the Metro Access Officer and the NDIS whatever officer, I call it, because it's basically doing anything to do with the NDIS, for the City of Yarra. My role is a community development role. However, in the last year or so, it's become the NDIS guru role, and I'm not a guru by no means. So, late last year, when it was announced that Yarra would be one of the first municipalities to be involved in the rollout of the NDIS, reactions within council varied. I was excited, but also wary as to what this might mean for current service users, some of whom would be eligible and some not for the scheme. My manager, who doesn't have a lot of hair, whilst also excited by the prospect, began pulling yet more hair out due to the possibility of introducing several new data collection and management systems into council. We were already undergoing changes with the with the aged care system, so he was quite stressed. My coordinator, who is a social worker, did the happy dance, and then she proceeded to analyse in depth what this would mean for our most vulnerable service users. So what did we do? We undertook to communicate with our residents and provide them with as much information as possible about the NDIS, what it might mean for them, and eligibility. So this is where the dot points start. We worked with disability service organisations such as the Association of Children with Disabilities, VALID, AMAZE, and others to run sessions both for service users as well as for staff who directly interacted with members of the community. We also participated in the first VALID Our Choices Expo to be held in Melbourne. There was, I think, about 100 exhibitors there, and it was a very awesome day. Lots of people came through and I think learnt a lot from what the different service providers and organisations had to offer. We worked with the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Disability Insurance Agency, and the National Disability Services. NDS is the peak body for service providers, to run 101 information sessions regarding the NDIS. And these sessions targeted the general public, people who were already on programs that had been identified as they would immediately roll over onto the NDIS, and also for service providers to learn more about the NDIS. We also identified groups within our community who we thought would find learning about the NDIS challenging. So homeless people, people living in shared supported accommodation, who often have either mental health issues or intellectual disabilities, people from cold background, with particular reference to our Vietnamese community, and also the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. With specific reference to the Aboriginal community, it proved to be quite difficult for that group to understand about the NDIS because they were just dealing with understanding about disability, let alone suddenly this new system that was going to make life amazing for everybody. In terms of those vulnerable groups, we chose to conduct a less informal information sessions, so where people could feel free to ask questions at any time during any of the presentations, and also have one-to-one access to either members of the Department of Health and Human Services or the National Disability Insurance Agency. We sent a number of letters to community members who were current council home care and service users, and we let them know about the NDIS, how they could find out more about it, what it would mean to them, and how to start the application and assessment process. We conducted a survey with our service users to gain an understanding on how much they knew about the NDIS, what they wanted to know more about, and we also asked them whether they thought we should be a registered service provider under the scheme. We used all of this information, as well as spent copious hours reading whatever was around, masses of documentation, opinion pieces and other relevant data that related to the NDIS, and we used all of this information to help council decide whether or not to be a service provider under the NDIS. As did all the other four councils under the North East Metropolitan Area, none of us have decided to be long-term service providers under the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Yarra, for instance, we are offering up to 3 months support after a person's plan has been implemented. A lot of that is about continuity and making sure that people are comfortable with possibly new carers and new people working within their space. We're trying to make the process as seamless as possible, basically. We would, however, continue to provide services to those who were not eligible for the scheme, just as before. We created two positions, one which is kind of mine. Apart from my Metro Access role, I'm deal with supporting people to access the NDIS who are our current service users, but they may also just be community members who may ring me. And we also had another position put in place to ensure that our systems were up to the task of meeting both the demands of the disability reforms as well as the aged care reforms. We created a space on our website which contains as up-to-date information as possible about the NDIS so people can go and have a look at what's happening. And finally, once the Brotherhood of St Lawrence was deemed our local area coordination service, we started working with them to help to bring people to their space and talk to them about and let them know about the pre-planning that was happening within the Brotherhood. So, what are the learnings? As this is quite a fluid process, the learnings are still happening. We're learning that for most of our residents that are eligible, they've had increases in both home care and community support. We've learnt that in some plans, travel has not been costed into their plan, so people have had to access programs through their own pocket. So if you're putting together a plan, don't forget to include transport. There was also one issue raised about a particular postcode that abounds two different municipalities, Yarra and Melbourne. And as we may all know, Melbourne is not part of the initial rollout. So one person was told they were not eligible for the scheme when indeed they lived in Yarra and they were eligible for the scheme. So they had to provide appropriate identification to show that they were. Just in conclusion, we're really looking forward to what is the rollout of the NDIS at Council, because we see that as people have more capacity, financial capacity to participate in the community, they will be able to use our services, our buildings, our community centres, our leisure centres. In the past, that has been a problem, and people for financial constraints have not been able to do that. So what I suggest to you, if you know your local council, then contact them. If you don't know your local council, then make yourself aware. Ring either the Metro Access Officer or the Rural Access Officer up in that council. Find out when the NDIS is rolling out in your area and make sure that you're on some kind of information distribution list so that you know what council is doing to assist you in learning more about the NDIS. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nadia. And I guess that gives everyone listening and here today a bit of an understanding of, you know, that local council might be giving you some information. So it's good to check out what your local council can do in terms of helping you to figure out this big bad thing we call the NDIS. Our next speaker is Michael Simpson. Michael is coming in by phone today, and I'm just going to check in to make sure that we have that set up. Michael, are you available for us to have you speak?
I hope you're hearing me, Leah.
Yes, we're hearing you loud and clear, and that's saying something coming from me. So, Michael is the general manager. Is a general manager, and I'm just going to pull up my notes because my iPad's decided to lock itself right at this moment.
Yeah, general manager, New South Wales Client Services, Leah.
Thank you, Michael. And in this context, Michael is responsible for frontline services and staff who are delivering services under both the NDIS and My Aged Care. Michael has been blind for over 40 years and was a former president of the BCA board. So we're actually switching topics now, and Michael is going to give us a bit of an overview of the structure around My Aged Care and touch a little bit on continuity of support. So, Michael, thank you for coming in. We won't hold it against you, but you're from New South Wales.
Thank you, Leah, and it is actually good to be with my Victorian BCA colleagues for this session, and really appreciate the information so far from both Catherine and Nadia, because in essence, the area that I'm going to be talking about, my aged care, is essentially the over 65s, whereas NDIS is in the main under 65s. Now, like in most areas of life, there are some grey elements here, and this is partly where continuity of care comes in, but also the overlap between NDIS and my aged care. But like NDIS, the introduction of the NDIS, the changes that government has made both to the funding arrangement and service access for people over the age of 65 through My Aged Care has meant quite considerable change both for people accessing services or looking to access services and for organisations delivering those services. And I'm sure that most of our BCA members in the forum today will know that in the main, NDIS is for people under the age of 65. However, if you access the NDIS prior to turning 65, you can continue accessing NDIS services or funding through your plan until you need to engage with an aged care relevant service. So that's where some of the elements around continuity of care come in, in terms of an NDIS participant, you can continue being an NDIS participant even post the age of 65, as long as you've accessed it prior to turning 65, until you come into the realm of needing to avail yourself of an aged care related service. So let's talk about the three tiers of aged care services, and they really are in essence tiers, because the first one around Commonwealth Home Support Program, community supports and home supports, it's about keeping people independent in their own home in the community. And these are the baseline services that through My Aged Care people will access, where they generally have low levels of need, and it can be episodic need, not almost daily or weekly needs, and they will access those services through funded organisations, including Vision Australia in the blindness and low vision space, where organisations like Vision Australia are funded under agreement, and then deliver a block of hours of services under a number of categories, and we'll talk about those categories in a minute. The next tier of services is the home care package tiers, and this is where people might need slightly more intensive and regular services than the baseline CHSP services. And there are four levels of package, level one through to package level four. And in essence, the dollar values available to individuals are about $8,000 worth of services under level one, up to just under $50,000 worth of services annually under package four. But when you're getting into those levels of packages, package three, package four type levels, then it would mean that that individual would be looking for services around dementia, home nursing services, more intensive services. But in the same way as the baseline services, the Commonwealth Home Support Program services, the home care packages are still aimed at keeping you in your own home and independent, relatively independent in the community. The third tier, however, is around having a person access an aged care facility. So this is where a person would no longer be living independently in their own home or in the community and would need to move into an aged care facility. But like NDIS, where there is a level of assessment around your particular needs, those assessments are also undertaken for access to the My Aged Care various tiers of services. And like NDIS, in some states and territories, those assessments are undertaken by assessors who are employed by community or non-government organisations, and in some places they will continue to be delivered through government organisations. Nadia mentioned that her local council area had been doing some work around My Aged Care for some time, or aged care services for some time. In Victoria, a couple of areas, so I'm imagining that one of them might have been the one of the areas that Nadia was talking about, moved to My Aged Care 12 months ago, but the rest of Victoria is only just now moving into the My Aged Care space. Most other areas around Australia, including New South Wales and Queensland, where Vision Australia has a critical mass of service delivery, moved fully to the My Aged Care space in July 2015. So New South Wales and Queensland, with myself and as General Manager in New South Wales and Karen Knight as General Manager Client Services in Queensland, have had more experience in this space than our Victorian counterparts. And in New South Wales and Queensland, the assessments are undertaken by what we call RAS assessors, Regional Assessment Service assessors, and these people are actually employed by non-government third-party organisations which have tendered to deliver those services. So big organisations like Suncare, Freres Health, a number of the larger organisations, Uniting Care, they contract, and even them sometimes, even they sometimes contract through subcontractors to deliver the RAS assessments for individuals to determine what level of access they might need to My Aged Care. Now let's go back to the baseline services, the CHSP services, Commonwealth Home Support Program services. I mentioned that there are different service types within that element. And this is where the assessors, by undertaking an assessment, and in most cases those assessments should be face-to-face, but we have actually learned that some of the subcontractors are undertaking those assessments by phone and not actually getting to actually see the individuals to really determine what their needs might be. Those assessors will determine what the need area is and therefore what category of service you might need to be accessing, and that will determine which organisation you might be referred to. Because on the Māori Aged Care Portal, which is the gateway for people to access these services, and people can access the My Aged Care portal through either online or by their contact centre. The assessment will determine whether you have a need for allied health, which is generally around occupational therapy. So in the Vision Australia context, that might be living skills delivered by an occupational therapist or those types of allied health services. It might be around transport, equipment, food services, which can include things like meals on wheels. But of late, there has been a new group of categories put in around specialised supports. There are five areas of specialised supports, and one of them is specialised support services, vision services. So a person who might have a need arising out of vision loss or blindness might generally be deemed to be referred to an organisation that is funded as a specialised support services, vision services category. There are other specialised support services around continence, Alzheimer's, hearing. There's only five specialised support services categories. What's happening for Vision Australia at the moment in Victoria is that Vision Australia and the Commonwealth Government are negotiating around the transition of funding that used to come through some federal funding through the old HAC services, Home and Community Care Services, and some Victorian-based funding that used to come through what used to be DHS, but I think became DHHS under the most recent government down there. That funding is transitioning into this space around My Aged Care. And currently the categories that look like being funded are around allied health, so the OT type services, social supports, and that could include things like, you'll know that Vision Australia runs some day programs, again, mostly for people who've lost sight later in life and have either low vision or no vision. Specialised support services vision, and under that category, we are able to deliver just about everything else that Vision Australia does, so orientation and mobility, adaptive technology training, braille training, all of those elements would fall, orthoptic assessments, all of those areas can come under the specialised support services vision category. We haven't actually signed off as yet that funding arrangement with the federal government, but it's likely that in Victoria that the funding will be significantly higher, and this is based on the fact that traditionally Vision Australia had a higher funding for both home and community care and disability services in Victoria than we did in New South Wales and Queensland. So that will then determine how many hours of service Vision Australia is funded to deliver to Victorians over the age of 65 who access services through the first level of of service, the Commonwealth Home Support Program. Some of you may be aware that Vision Australia is also funded to deliver some packages, home care packages in Victoria. We're actually funded to deliver about 140 packages, of which I think around 100 are already allocated. Some of those are level one, and some are up into the level two and three tier. But again, like NDIS, there are still significant changes in the wind. And as from February next year, there will be additional changes brought into the aged care space. So, for example, as from the end of February next year, even the home care packages, the $8,000 to $48,000 packages that I've talked about, that currently get allocated to an organisation and then the organisation allocates them to individuals, those packages will actually become part of a national pool, and when somebody is deemed to need a particular level of package, regardless of where they might be, could be Victoria, could be Queensland, then they will have access to the next package that becomes available.
Michael, just a note, but you've got 1 minute left.
Yep.
And then we're all coming up to New South Wales to get you.
I'll be finished in 1 minute. And the other significant change is that people will have full portability of their package. So if they currently have a home care package with being delivered by a particular agency, they can actually choose to take that package to another agency to manage for them. So like NDIS, there are still significant changes in the aged care space as well. Thank you, Leah.
Thanks for that great overview, Michael. And I was just getting worried about how we were going to transport everyone up there. So that's a great overview. And now we're going to hear from someone who is a consumer in the My Aged Care Scheme. This is Pete Sumner. Pete has been blind since the age of 19. He served for a long time as a teacher at what was the old Talking Book and Braille Library, and then went on to found with his wife Pearl CBM, which used to be known as Christian Blind Mission. These days, Pete is semi-retired and enjoys philosophy, gardening, and long walks with his wife and their two guide dogs. Please welcome Pete, who's going to give us a bit of a consumer perspective on My Aged Care.
Well, thank you, everybody. It's nice to share this with you. And this is very much where the rubber hits the road sort of a talk. My wife and I are both vision impaired or living with sight loss, whichever way you want to put it. And we both have guide dogs, and we live in Beaumaris, which is in the Bayside area of Melbourne, just to give a bit of context. So we came into contact with the home care package program, which is one of the levels that Michael has just talked about. Through our local council, we were receiving some, domestic help, home cleaning service from the local council, and someone from there said, well, look, you probably need to go onto a more comprehensive sort of support program. Have you thought about a home care package? We didn't know what that was. So they arranged for someone from what's called ACAS to come out. That's the Aged Care Assessment Service, to come out and talk to us about our situation, our needs, and how we were coping as a blind couple living alone, that is, without sighted support in our own home. And the outcome of that was that they said, look, we think we can recommend you each for a package, and probably the most appropriate provider would be Vision Australia, of course, who had just more or less entered into that field. Now, we're talking about back in 2013, towards the end of 2013. So we've been in the program now for 3 years. And I might say that Vision Australia at that time was just launching into that service and the providing of those packages themselves. So we were all very new at it, very inexperienced, and had to sort of virtually feel our way forward, as we all know what that means. And so I won't go into all the details for lack of time, but we got into the program. Case manager came out from the Dandenong office of Vision Australia and organised our packages, my wife first, and then a couple of months later, another package became available and I was able to get involved in it. So what it actually means in terms of money is that you get about $1,240 a month extra. That is in addition to your disability pension, which goes into a special account held by the provider. And this special account is to help provide for your special needs as an older person with vision loss and also issues relating to ageing. And this fund is to pay for services and sometimes goods that you may need to help you to live independently and remain independent in your own home, as Michael said, for as long as possible, till you get to a point where your health fails or something and you need to go into a special facility and have much more support. So I should add, my wife and I are on level two. Michael spoke of four levels, one and two, which is generally for low-level support, and levels three and four for high-level, sort of ending up in full nursing home care and so on. So we're on level two. And so what about the actual funding arrangements, fees and costs and so on? Well, the first thing we discovered was that although the government had wonderfully and generously provided this amount of money, the provider immediately took a third, nearly a third, 30% for administration fees. We tried to find out what exactly those administration costs were, but we never received any, you know, very specific answers. Just generally it was stated it was overhead. So a third is taken out, or 30%, and the rest is used then to help, you know, with your various services that you need to fund. There was actually another snag as well we found, and that was that Vision Australia, as a provider, has adopted what they call a full recovery policy with regard to their costs in running this home care package program, which means basically they don't want to be out of pocket for any service that they provide. So they, on top of the administration fee, they also charge fees for your case manager's time. Any emails your case manager may send to you or receive from you and reading them. Any phone calls they make. In other words, it's a bit like a legal office. You know, you can't step into a lawyer's office without them charging you for every fax or phone call or email, or they charge you by the minute. And actually, Vision Australia, as a provider, charges you by the minute for any conversation or intercourse you have with the office, which also you've got to be very careful about, because if it, you know, you have long conversations and write many emails and so on asking for advice, as we did in the beginning, we found when we got our monthly statement at the end that we had been charged for all that. And so you learn to be very circumspect in how you approach the office or deal with your case manager, because you are going to be charged for those services. We don't feel that's quite fair. So we're hoping to address that in future. So as time is short, I'll go on now and say that we found that when we first had the program, we had to accept a care plan that was provided for us. We didn't know that we could be involved in the setting out of the care plan, but I'm sure Vision Australia did their best and according to the information that they had. But at first, we were told that we could not receive any report, any support for our guide dogs. It, you know, the services and things only applied to us. In the beginning, we were told that there was only there was a $100 cap on adaptive technology that we could purchase through the program. We were told about certain services, additional paramedical services that we could get, but some others were not mentioned, which we only found out about later. And also we were told that we could only engage contractors that were approved by the provider. These tended to be very expensive contractors, and we learned later that we could choose our own. So what happened was, by one means and another, we finally got hold of, my wife and I got hold of, the HCPP operator's manual, which is the document that tells what you can get, what you can't get, how the money can be used, the way in which it's to be applied, and this and that and all the other thing. And we were able to get this transferred into an accessible format that we could read, and we went through the fine print bit by bit, made notes and analysed it, and one thing and another, and we found to our amazement that guide dogs could be supported through the program, that there was no cap on adaptive technology that could be purchased through the program, and that there were things like dentistry available through the program that, and even when we raised it with our case manager, she said, oh no, that's not possible. But I said, yes it is. It's there in the fine print. And also we found that we did not have to accept the contractors that they said. So I'm just saying that consumers need to be aware. They need to be savvy, this is the best way to get your needs and goals met. And though we haven't got time to cover more now, I'm very happy to consult with anybody who would like to get in touch with me personally by phone or email or by some other means, and I'll give them more details about setting out care plans and so on that will get you the results that you need from your HCPP plan. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. That's a great story to have heard, and good to hear that you were able to empower yourself along the journey. And that's the topic of our final speaker, Lauren Henley. So Lauren is currently a project officer for Blind Citizens Australia and a policy and research officer for the Youth Disability Advocacy Service, based here in Victoria. Lauren is going to speak to us today about both systems, really, the NDIS and My Aged Care, and what you can do if things might go wrong. And I've just seen that a microphone's been very kindly moved so that I don't have to worry about hitting Lauren in the nose by moving mine around. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Leah. Sorry, if that doesn't... Okay, cool. Just have to be a bit closer to it. All right, I just wanted to get a sense of something before I go into my spiel. So I want to get a sense from everyone in the room who might still be feeling a little bit cautious, not so sure about how to navigate all the systems we're talking about and get what they need. Now, I'm not going to see your hands, so I want you to get really passionate about this. And on the count of three, if this is you, if you're still a little bit cautious, I want you to yell out, "What was America thinking?" One, two, three. Okay, good. Well, I don't know about you lot, but I feel a lot better, so thank you. So it sounds like there is still a little bit of fear in the room, and I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that, because the fear is very real. This is a major transition we're going through at the moment. The way we've accessed disability services in this country has been the same for many, many years, and now the system's being turned upside down. I think eventually we'll realise that what's happening is the system is actually being turned up the right way rather than upside down, but we aren't quite there yet, and things are still a little bit confusing and scary. The first thing I want you all to remember is that you're not on your own here. BCA's core strengths are advocacy and peer support, so we're here to help each other through this transition as best we can. Today, though, I'd like to give you all a bit of information that you can use to make sure you get what you need in this new world of disability care and support. I'll start with the under 65s, so those people who hopefully will be eligible for the NDIS. Once you're approved as being eligible for the NDIS, you'll go through a planning process to talk about what you want to do with your life and what supports you might need. If you're eligible for an individually funded package of supports under the NDIS, it's this process that will determine how much funding you're given. Here are a few facts that might help you get what you need out of this process. So first of all, it's up to you how you want your planning meeting to happen. If you get a phone call from someone who wants to conduct your planning meeting over the phone, you do have the right to ask for it to happen face-to-face if you'd find that easier. If you don't feel like you're prepared for your planning meeting and you haven't had enough time to think about what you need, you can also request more time. You can also have other people at your planning meeting with you if you want. This might be someone like a friend or family member, an advocate, or both. I'd actually encourage most people to have an advocate at their first meeting if possible, not because I think you're incompetent, but because the NDIS is being rolled out so fast and planners are being recruited so fast that we're hearing some real horror stories. An extra pair of ears will just help you hold the planner accountable for what is said during the planning meeting. Last point on planning, if you really don't get along with the planner you've been given or the local area coordinator as it may be, if you don't feel like they understand your disability or they aren't listening to what you need, you can actually request a new one. Okay, so the planning process has happened, but there are services or supports you really need, ones you think are reasonable and necessary, that the National Disability Insurance Agency, or NDIA, says they won't approve. What can you do? The first step involves you asking the National Disability Insurance Agency to review their decision internally. You need to do this within 3 months of the date the decision was made, and you can do this by writing to the CEO of the NDIA, by requesting a review orally at an NDIA office, by phoning the agency, or by sending them an email. If you still don't get a satisfactory outcome once the decision has been reviewed by the NDIA, you can apply for it to be reviewed externally through the Administrative Appeals Tribunal within 28 days of you receiving the decision from the NDIA. And while that sounds really scary and legalistic, there is support available to help you with this. The federal government has provided funding to a number of advocacy services to enable them to provide advocacy and legal representation for individuals seeking external review of decisions made in relation to the NDIS. The agency that's been funded to undertake this work in Victoria is REAC, which is the Rights Information and Advocacy Centre. While that's the organisation that's been funded to undertake that work, that doesn't prevent you from using an advocate from another organisation if that's your preference. And by the way, decisions made in relation to what's reasonable and necessary are not the only decisions that can be reviewed through this process. There's also other decisions that can be reviewed, like decisions made in relation to eligibility. Okay, so you've got funding for the supports you need, hopefully, but you're having an issue with one of your service providers. What can you do? This one's really easy. Threaten to take your money elsewhere. This isn't actually charity anymore. You're a paying customer and this is business. You should expect high quality and accessible services that meet your needs. And if that sounds familiar, I stole it from BCA's mission statement. Sadly, not intentionally. I've written it so many times, it just fell out of my head. Okay, so under 65s, I think you've had enough airtime, and our over 65s aren't getting any younger, so over to you. As we know, if you're 65 years or older, when the NDIS hits your area, you won't be eligible for the scheme. Although if you'll only narrowly miss out on entering the NDIS because of your age, there are early entry provisions that may still allow you to get in. If you think you might fit into this category, I'd encourage you to seek support from an advocate immediately. First point for the over 65s. If you were already accessing disability services of some kind before the NDIS rolled out in your area, you should still continue to receive this support, and it should be consistent with your current arrangements. The Department of Health is rolling out a new program called the Commonwealth Continuity of Support Program to make sure that that actually happens. It's a back-of-house arrangement, though, which means that you shouldn't need to do anything in order to be entered into the program. It should just happen automatically. But there are some providers that won't be registered to provide supports under the Commonwealth Continuity of Support Program. And if yours is one of them, it is possible that you may have to find a new service provider. This program doesn't kick off properly until next year, and it's being rolled out progressively, just like the NDIS. Because of this, there are still a lot of unknowns, but please monitor the support you're receiving, and if things change, contact an advocacy organisation like Blind Citizens Australia immediately, because the government always promised that nobody would be worse off under these new arrangements, and we need to hold them accountable. Even if you are rolled into the Commonwealth Continuity of Support Program, it's possible that your needs might change over time and that you might need additional support. If this happens, you'll need to access this support through My Aged Care. Peter's already spoken at length about how the scheme works, so I won't go over old territory, but I do want to focus for a moment on co-payments, so you know what your rights are in this space. So the main difference between NDIS and aged care, or one of the main differences, NDIS, you don't pay a co-payment. My Aged Care, you are required to contribute towards your care and support arrangements. So there's basic daily fees that apply to services that are registered to provide support under My Aged Care. The maximum daily fee for a home care package currently averages out at just under $10 a day. All individuals on a home care package can be asked to pay the daily basic fee, while others may be asked to pay more depending on their income and assets. The amount of money you'll be expected to contribute to your aged care services is ultimately negotiated between you and your service provider. Once these costs have been agreed upon, they'll be written up in a formal agreement. I know that some older people with disability have successfully had their co-payments waived by negotiating with their service provider and putting a strong case forward as to why they should not be charged. We would also encourage others to try this approach. If you have no luck, though, and contributing to your care and support arrangements would cause you financial hardship, you can also apply for the hardship supplement. If you're assessed as being unable to pay part or all of the required co-payments once submitting your application, the government can step in and make sure you still get the support you need. To apply for the hardship supplement, you'll need to submit a formal application to the Department of Health and Human Services. Sorry, that's the wrong one. That's the state one. It's the Department of Human Services, federally. Now, remember, if you're having trouble navigating the maze that is the aged care system or things go wrong, there is help out there. If you have a problem that you've not been able to resolve with your service provider, you can lodge a complaint with the Aged Care Complaints Commissioner. Once your complaint has been accepted, the Commissioner may be able to investigate and help you to resolve the matter. You can also contact a disability advocacy organisation like Blind Citizens Australia for assistance, or you can contact an aged care advocacy service. The National Aged Care Advocacy Line will be able to direct you to the most appropriate aged care advocacy service, but the one operating in Victoria is called Elder Rights Advocacy. That's a pretty quick and dirty Advocacy 101 to help guide you through this new and wondrous world of disability care and support. I imagine you're probably feeling a little bit daunted by all the information you've heard today, because there's quite a lot that we need to consider. And as I said before, it's not easy, and we're very right to have a bit of caution in approaching this. So if you do have more questions, happy to take those in a moment. I'll also be here for the rest of the day and throughout dinner. And apart from that, you'll find me in the BCA office. Well done. Well done.
Thank you to Lauren and to all of our speakers today. So now we're going to have some time for questions. And I just want to flag that for people listening on the stream, you can text me. So if you're texting with a question and you want to make some jokes about the chair of the session, your question may not get to air. But otherwise, my number is 0430 210 980. That's 0430 210 980. So I'll give a moment to see if there are any
texts coming through, but does anyone on the floor have questions? Raise your hand if you do.
Michael James, I'll start by saying what the hell were immigrants thinking again, because I'm still confused on both fronts. Just and it is a question from a personal point of view. I come from a mixed marriage. Yes, we're both white Anglos. Yes, we have the same religious persuasion, but we have different disabilities. I have vision impairment. My wife has multiple sclerosis. The services we may require and the challenges we face in life often impact upon the other person's disability, and similarly their disability impacts upon services we may require. Is there any provision for providing services to, if you like, a couple or a family rather than treating everybody individually? And I don't care who addresses that question.
We're talking about NDIS?
NDIS, sorry, yes.
So NDIS? Lauren. All right. So
did you want to say something? Oh. Did you want to say Lauren? Or do you want me? You can. You go first.
We've got a break out of politeness on the panel. I think I'm going to say Kathy goes first because she's got a microphone there.
Yes, so one of the things that I would encourage you to do when you're first contacted is to talk about the complexity of your situation, which will give you... I talked about the streaming before, which immediately puts you into a more complex situation where you, that will give you more capacity to talk about the complexity of your situation. Lauren might know more about the... detail in terms of the way that it's managed, but the whole thing about the NDIS is about your personal situation and your personal context. Now, you will only get a package that's about you, and your wife will only get a package about her if you're both eligible. But within those packages, you can talk about what happens in your family life, and that would be the way that you would manage some of that. Sort of shared over, you know, the overlapping impact, both good and, you know, the upside and challenges of that shared arrangement.
I can add something here. Also, as I mentioned, my wife and I are also a kind of mixed marriage. My wife also has another disability in a serious hearing loss. But with regard to the funding arrangements, we found after some time in the program that our packages, as far as the funding, could be pooled. You know, you can only spend as much as you've got in your account. If you spend up big, you have little left and fewer options as to what else you can do. But if there is a couple, you can pool both accounts by agreement with your provider, so that if one account is running low or short, you can use funds in the other account by mutual agreement to fund some necessary service or device that you need.
Can you do that in NDIS?
I don't actually know, to be honest. I don't have the answer to that question, but I'm happy to take it on notice and find out.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that you can pull quite... I think you can... there are a number of people, so for instance, I know a couple with cerebral palsy who are together, and they're able to share. So what they do is have one support worker for the two of them, so they sort of manage to get support workers for longer. But I still understand that it doesn't come out of a pooled account, that on day, you know, on Monday it would come out of his account and on Tuesday it would come out of her account. So I'm not absolutely... I think Lauren's best place to research that. I'm not sure that you can actually have a shared account in NDIS.
And what I will say to that is, if there's any questions people have here today that we can't answer, that sort of informs the work we're doing at Blind Citizens Australia, and I'm happy to go off and research that, and we can make sure we make that information available to you sometime in the near future.
And I can just give a practical example. Earlier this year, we recognised that we needed... an Optelec reading machine, that's like a CCTV, so we could read bills and other things, that information that was coming into the house that we needed to deal with. That costs about $5,000. Neither of us had that amount in our accounts at that particular time, so we were able to split the bill and take $2,500 out of each and thus acquire the device that we needed. So there's just an example of what happened.
Sorry, I'm only just discussing the technicality of it. I believe what you just described then is possible under the NDIS. It's just that that's a difference. There's a difference between having a combined account and taking half from each account. That's the only. I was only talking about the technicality of it.
Yep. Okay, so that's a really good question. We have a text now, before we go to another one from the floor. The text is, I was wondering if the NDIS will affect a person's eligibility for taxi subsidies. And this is from Vanessa Ransley, who I believe is in the room.
How mysterious.
That's a bit cheeky. We must go over to the left-hand side of the room next. Eligibility for taxi subsidies. So, as Lauren said, you need to make sure that you get travel in your package. Again, BCA might know again a little bit more about the details of how it works, but your eligibility for taxi subsidies is to do with your eligibility for the disability support pension. No? Well, this is Laura. You're gonna. Is it part of your disability package or part of the NDIS or part of the?
So this is to do with. It's a question about the M40 card or its equivalents in other states, which gives you half price taxi fares. And so I think maybe the people to answer this would be Lauren and Nadia. Nadia, do you have anything to say on this?
Yep, my understanding is that it does impact on your card and that you should be including transport costs into your package, and that includes weekends, weekdays, basically all the travel that you do with your taxi, and that applies the same as the mobility allowance. I think that is also taken out or withdrawn when you include your travel costs in your plans. The problem has been, in our experience, that some planners have not paid enough attention to travel costs, and people are becoming a cropper when they've spent their travel money in
the package. Just before we go to Lauren, it's John Simpson. I just want to caution, for not so much people in the room, but people listening, that this is very much a state-by-state issue, and BCA knows that it's a major issue in Tasmania, for example, because of decisions that the state government have taken in terms of transferring money into the NDIS program that that was earmarked for their taxi subsidy program. And we know there are very substantial variations from state to state. So I just caution, particularly for people listening from interstate, that an answer that we give in relation to Victoria may not be the case in other states. Lauren, did you want to add anything?
Well, just to say that I think I have more research to do, because I know when the trial was happening in Barwon, the situation was that you still continued using your taxi card, and then the NDIA would pay for the other half of your taxi fare. And then if for some reason you weren't actually eligible for a taxi card, such as myself, then they would just pay the whole amount. But according to what you've said, Nadia, that's actually changed since trial. Is that correct?
Well, today. I don't guarantee that tomorrow it'll be the same. But we've had people who have had their multipurpose taxi program cards taken away. So whether that's been done whether that's been a correct process or not, that's what's happened with some of our service users. So I'd be really keen what you find out, because then I can follow that up with our service users as well as to whether that's correct or not.
Sure, we'll make sure we clarify that for people.
Can I mention about the aged care arrangement with that?
Sure, we'll just hear from Peter quickly about the aged care arrangement for that as well.
When you're with HCPP, you can make sure that taxi transport is written into your care plan, and the provider, in this case Vision Australia, will provide you with cab charge cards. But, of course, that comes out of your package. It's not Vision Australia paying for it. You're paying for it out of your package. But they do provide the cab charge cards, which can be used in connection with your M40.
Okay, thanks for that clarification, Peter. It's good to understand the differences between the systems. Now, I believe we have a question from Deb Simons in the room.
Hi, I actually work as a local area coordinator, but I'm not here to answer any other questions. In terms of... Sorry, is that better? In terms of travel, mobility allowance transfers over, so you don't get it paid as you do, but it gets picked up by NDIS. And they will also pick up a component of normal travel, probably not if you're going to go from home to the shops necessarily, but if you're going to services, and they'll factor that in. So you just need to talk to your coordinator about that.
Thanks for that, Deb. Now, do we have any other questions?
Right.
Anyone?
Hi. Right, it's, over on the left. Yep, it's Carmel Jolly. I have a question. What advice would you give people who are on the cusp? So next year, when it's rolled out to other local government areas, people may be nearly 65, not quite. So should they go on NDIS or MAC, or how would they? What's the best way for them to work out what to do?
Okay, so Lauren is fondling the microphone here.
Don't say it like that. It makes me sound so seedy. I've forgotten the question now.
It was about people on the cusp.
I think I've turned bright red. Anyway, people on the cusp. I would really... Stop it, Emma. I would encourage you to try and get into the NDIS if you can, because there's certainly been more thought put into it and it hasn't been rolled out so haphazardly. So what I would encourage you to do is talk to an advocacy organisation. Ricky, I'm sorry if it's directed at BCA, but you're going to have to deal with that. But it does differ in each state and territory how they're dealing with this issue. There are early access provisions for those people who are just on the cusp, but it differs from state to state, and the legislation around it is extremely confusing.
And I would just add to that one of the first things to find out would be what the rollout schedule is for your part of the state. So, for instance, were you to pick a random area in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, Carmel, you would be looking at the NDIS coming in November of next year. So factoring that into what your strategy might be. So now do we have any more questions in the room?
Yeah, and Lee,
yes?
Any other...
Okay.
Just Leah, I was just going
to... Ricky Chaplin here.
Hang on.
Oh, mic's not on. Yep, now it is. It's Ricky Chaplin here. Just a comment on that last... I think it's really important for people to approach BCA with all sorts of different scenarios that you come up against, because it's probably going to inform the kind of work that we might be able to do under the information linkages and capacity building part of the NDIS. I don't think we're going to cover that in depth today, but it's going to give us an idea of the kind of success that we might have in advocating for the sorts of things that people are going to need. So by all means, approach us with anything you have.
Thanks for that, Ricky. Are there other questions in the room?
Yes.
Yes, okay, we'll move to the next question.
Me.
Okay. Can I hear my mic? She might have to grab Nadia's mic.
Thank you. So I have a question about, I suppose, how to kind of quantify things. I've heard mixed things around for people whose needs are more episodic. So, for example, when I joined the NDIS, one of the things that I would probably need most would be orientation and mobility services. And I've heard mixed things. On one hand, people are saying, oh, you've got to say how many sessions it's going to take you to learn how to get from A to B, and other people say no, you can just have as many as you like and use them as you need it, which is kind of what I'm used to and would be my preferred option, because depending on the complexity of the route that I'm learning, I have no idea how long it's going to take me to figure that stuff out. So can someone give any clarification around that sort of stuff?
Okay, so Catherine is holding onto a microphone, not fondling it. And I believe, Nadia, do you have some comment on this as well?
No.
No, okay, so we'll start with Kathy.
In this case, what happens is that you do need to have an idea of how many hours or sessions that you might need at the beginning of the, when you go into your plan. So you might look at the last couple of years and say, oh, I've used, for example, 50 hours. I don't know what sort of number of hours go into these things, but 50 hours. And then you would get, then what they would do is that there's a standard, what they call a unit price, and they would work out a budget amount. So say you got, then there'd be an amount in your budget. Then you can use that whenever and whenever you want. So it might average out at 1 hour per week, but of course you can just use it when you want. So the important part is that you do end up with a budget amount in your plan, and that needs to have some basis. Now, next year, you might find that you run out really quickly or that you only use part of it. That means that informs how much might go into your budget the following year. But you do need to have an idea of the number of sessions, but you don't have to say, oh, I'm going to use one session a month. What the number of sessions does is make sure there's enough in your budget, and then you use that budget up over the year. You might use none for 11 months and you might use it all up in the last month because that's what you need or not. So the important part is having an idea. Yeah, you have to look at the last few years and just hope that average, or maybe add a bit on because you think you're going to change jobs or you might move house or whatever, so that might add a premium onto it. But you do have to have a little bit of an idea to help them create the budget.
And just to add to that, before we go to the next question, if you do have a change in your life circumstances, like Catherine was just saying, if you were to change your job or to move house and you needed more O&M, one of the reasons you can go back to the agency and say, I need to review my plan, is because you've had life changes.
Sorry, possibly the only reason you can go back to the agency and change your plan is because you've had a change in your life circumstances. Yes.
Yeah. So you don't have to think about every possibility, but you do have to know that if something changes drastically, then you can go back and talk to them about that.
Yep. And that would mean go contact your local area coordinator.
Yep. So next question. Okay, Michael. We'll let the New South Welshman speak.
Sorry, Leah. I just wanted to make a comment on this one from a service provider perspective, because our experience has certainly been that where the planning process has identified that a service needs to be delivered but can't actually be quantified right at the beginning of the planning process, whilst service providers aren't generally involved in the formal planning process, NDIA do go to service providers to get estimates on the amount of service delivery that might be required. So some examples might be where somebody is requiring a full-on Braille program or a long cane program or even adaptive technology training. The individual might not have an idea of how many hours or sessions or episodes that they might be requiring during a year. NDIA or the planning process can actually engage with service providers to make an assessment of that. And that also extends to the provision of accessible format production. So in the planning process, a person might say, look, and I think I'll need, half a dozen books put into Braille during the year. Well, how many pages? Well, I don't know. I don't know exactly what the books are yet. So a provision can be made, and then as the person requires that material, the planner and the fund can then purchase that along the way.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, Michael. Are there more questions from the floor?
Can Michael hear me? Michael, are you talking about that as your experience during trial or since transition to full scheme?
No, even transition to full scheme. Okay. We are still seeing the planners where there might be a requirement, and orientation mobility is a perfect example, because you don't know how many sessions or how many hours it's going to take, often they will approach a service provider. It might be Vision Australia, might be Guide Dogs, might be RSB, depending on where it is, and get an assessment of how many hours it might require or how many sessions it might require.
I think that's actually part of the assessment, the assessments that they put in. So they get some assessment, you know, if you want some sort of supports, they put an assessment in. The only bit about that conversation that is once the plan is in place, you won't be able to change the amount midway through unless there's a change in your circumstance. So that,
yeah, I might be talking about the planning process.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it sounded a bit like, when you were explaining it, it sounded like you could go back after you'd had it, like, you know, after you've maybe got a certain number of books done, that maybe you're going, oh, actually, I want more. You wouldn't be able to put it in that same 12 months. It would have to wait till the next 12 months once the planning process is finished.
Yeah, yeah. What I was talking about there is you might not know at the beginning exactly the dollar value of conversion from, say, printing to Braille. So there is opportunity for people to have the access to accessible format in their plan without a specific dollar amount.
Okay, so is there anything more you want to say on that, Kathy, or are we okay to move on to the next question?
No, I was only going to talk about reference packages, but I don't know whether that's worthwhile. Well,
that sounds scary.
That sounds scary. Yeah. We'll leave that alone. All
right. Are there any more questions? No, it looks like we have exhausted your curiosity. If you do have more questions, is there one up the back? There's a couple. Here we go.
Hello, Debbie Cook here. I just would like to. That's back on. Ask about the. I mean, what types of books would an individual necessarily ask for? Because I understood that books that would be done that would go through the library. So are we talking about personal support or study text? I was just wondering if we could get a bit more clarification on what types of material that people could request, and then would that be available to the general population?
Okay, that's a good question. So,
Leah? I was going to say Michael can probably take that one.
Sure.
Yeah, are you hearing
Lauren
me?
Lauren is going to make a comment on that.
Michael, do you want to go first? Sorry.
Bit of a difference.
Okay. Yeah, Debbie mentioned the Personal Information Provision Service, what we refer to as PIP, and that's essentially where individuals do bring material that they are requiring for their personal support. So it's not generic reading material like newspapers, magazines, general titles that are available in through the library. This might be material including personal correspondence, personal contracts, interestingly, including the NDIS planning process. A good example might be a family with a child who happens to be blind might want some print books to have Braille overlaid on those print books, and that is specifically for that family, for that child. So they would be perfect examples of what would go into an NDIS plan.
Sounds like you're flatlining.
Can I just add to that and say I sing in a choir, so I need my music transcribed into Braille, so that would be another example of a service that I would require to be funded through the NDIS, I would imagine.
Okay, so that's good. We've got another question, I think.
Yes, this is Helen Freres. Okay, hopefully that's coming through clearly now. Because the question is there an overall strategy in addition to feedback from individuals to monitor both the quality of service provided by established and perhaps emerging providers and the pricing structures so that over time costs don't blow out to the point where funding packages aren't adequate to meet needs? Thank you.
Okay, Helen, is that a question about NDIS or aged care or both?
Apply to both.
Both. Okay. So I think Catherine, and then we might go to Michael as well.
Yep. So the way that a budget is put together is the NDIA actually states what the unit price is for every type of support. And the unit price is a bitterly fought out thing between service providers and the NDIA. But what happens is that that service, in your plan, you only get X many dollars per hour for, you know, for each service or per item. So when you talk about cost blowout, you are not able as an NDIS participant to pay more than the unit cost unless you're self-managing. And if you self-manage and you pay more per unit cost, then you will get fewer hours of that thing. And so clearly as a consumer, you will be looking to try and make your dollar go as far as you can. Certainly you can buy those same things at a lower price if that's possible and if you can be sure of the quality. But in the same way that the rest, one of the mechanisms there is just consumer behaviour. In the same way that if we all tell each other that if we buy a certain brand of something, it's not very good, don't buy it, buy another one, that will be one of the quality mechanisms. That's I'm talking about besides the standard quality frameworks that will be in place. But apart from that, that's one of the things about the market environment. If people don't provide a good product that meets your needs, then as Lauren said earlier, take your money and go somewhere else. But in terms of cost blowing out, the NDIA's got a fairly iron fist on that unit price.
So we're going to hear from Michael. Michael, it would be good if you could explain what the situation is for aged care, and then Lauren has a comment.
Yeah, in the aged care space, I mentioned earlier that Vision Australia and I imagine other Victorian-based providers are still negotiating what they will deliver under the Commonwealth Home Support Program, as we did in New South Wales and Queensland. A good example is that Vision Australia in Queensland was receiving, prior to the introduction of the new My Aged Care approach, was receiving just over $80,000 a year of funding for aged care services. And the negotiations require organisations to set an hourly rate for various types of services, like allied health might be at one rate, specialised support services, vision might be at another rate, social supports might be at another rate, similar to what Catherine was saying with NDIS in terms of the service types. Now, in Queensland, for example, in the first 9 months of calendar year 2016, Vision Australia was funded to deliver 600 hours of specialised support services in the Vision area, only 600, and we delivered over 6,500 hours. So 6,000 of those hours were funded through other means, including community fundraising. In the areas that Peter was talking about, it's up to the provider of those services to negotiate rates for things like lawn mowing, home cleaning, your home-based nursing, those sorts of services that are delivered into people's homes to keep them independent under the home care package arrangements. Peter was mentioning issues around fees. Prior to July 2015, organisations didn't even have to disclose to their home care package users what fees they were applying. Now those fees have to be very transparent to the user, and as I was mentioning, as from February next year, users of home care packages can actually move their provider. They can choose based on fees, hourly rates, a whole range of things to choose their provider. So that again will put the power and control in the hands of consumers.
Thanks. That's a good point to end on. We're going to Lauren and then Nadia.
Okay. I'll just be quick. There's a website called Clickability. It is basically a consumer-led movement which it lists different service providers throughout Australia, and users, the people who are using those service providers or have used those service providers, will leave information about how they found the quality of service to be, so that people can go and review that and make an informed decision about whether or not they might want to give that service a go. The only thing I'll say about that is that because the NDIS is so new for service providers, they're having to make a lot of different decisions on the fly. So you might have a bad experience with them now, but it doesn't mean that they, you know, they might lift their standards in a little while. For example, I recently moved back to Victoria, I needed some O&M, and Guide Dogs told me they couldn't do it outside business hours, and I work, so that really didn't wash with me. And I threatened to take my money elsewhere, and they went back to the drawing board, thought about this whole NDIS thing. Now they're quite happy to do that. So you will find that things change over time as well.
Okay, Nadia. And then we might have one last question from the floor, and we'll wrap up the session.
Following on from Lauren's comment about clickability, there are a number of other websites that you can go to that are similarly based. One is also called Care Navigator. And then to answer a little bit or to add comment to Helen's question, one of the reasons why certainly the five local government areas that are currently involved in the rollout of the NDIS chose not to be a registered service provider was that the cost that had been given by the the NDIA as to how much home care services should be costing were far below the cost that it's actually that council is incurring, and so apart from that reason, there were a number of other reasons, but that was one of the major reasons why the councils are not becoming long-term registered service providers.
Okay, thanks for that, Nadia. And our last question is from Christine Simpson.
Thanks, Leah. Two quick questions, please. First being, if money is received for a service such as an O&M service and then the consumer decides they don't need it, can that money be switched over to another service, or does it have to be returned? And secondly, picking up on something Michael said before, Michael, if I understood you correctly, you were saying that a personal document could be perhaps the contract between the NDIS and yourself that one might want in Braille. I would have thought that it would not be the consumer's responsibility to get that into their preferred format, but rather the provider's responsibility or government's responsibility or someone's, but certainly not mine.
Okay, so who wants to have a go at this?
I can certainly do the first. I can do the first part of that.
Sorry, Catherine?
I can answer the first.
Yep, all right.
So the first question was about if you had money in your plan to do one sort of activity, whether what happened to that. So what happens in your plan is you have various sections in the plan. So you might have some money for core supports, such as, you know, helping with your daily activities, getting out of bed or whatever might help in terms of personal supports. And then you might have some other supports for, as I mentioned before, what's the one for housing modifications and stuff? What's our C there?
Core, capacity building and capital.
Capital. So you might have your capital supports, and then the one, what you were talking about, O&M type of thing, would fall under capacity building. Now, in general, you can't go between those. So money that you might be given for a housing modification cannot be used for any other purpose. It's called a fixed support and it's not flexible at all. Within your capacity building, you might have three or four different types of capacity building, and as long as they are called flexible in your plan, then you can use money between them. So you might have a certain amount of money for O&M and you might have a certain amount of money for community participation, you might have a certain amount of money for some personal skills development or whatever. It's if they're designated as flexible, then you are able to use money between those things. But then there are other things that are not flexible at all. So when you're talking to them in your plan, you might want to ask them about what things can be flexible and what things can't be.
Okay, that's great. And I want to check in, because that's the NDIS. Michael or Peter? Michael or Peter, do you have a quick word to say about whether you can do that in My Aged Care?
Yeah, Leah, I'll try and be really quick because Christine's question was really still around NDIS and the provision of an NDIS plan in accessible format. The main contracts that I was talking about are personal documents where, for example, I might be wanting to get a house loan or something like that. If I want to get that document, I can argue with the bank to give it to me in accessible format. But if they don't, and I want it put into accessible format, that could actually go into my plan, if my NDIS plan, if I knew about it early enough. In terms of people's NDIS plans, our experience so far is that the NDIA and their planners, and even local area coordinators, are pretty poor at providing accessible documentation for people who are blind and have low vision. We have been doing a number of plans in Braille, and both NDIA and the local area coordinators have told us that, look, you know, this is required by a person who is blind. It isn't in their plan. We don't have any provision for providing it, so over to Vision Australia. Now, we've been doing that at no cost, but Christine's quite right. It really should, the onus should be on the planning agency, whether that's NDIA or one of their contracted agents, to make that material available in accessible format.
Okay, thanks, Michael. And I think we'll give the last word to our consumer rep on the panel and then we'll wrap up.
Well, all I can say is that when we looked into the operations document, we found that it was absolutely mandatory that the provider provide a monthly statement of your account so you can see how much is left in your account and what it was used for in the previous month, in an accessible format. So we wrote that into our care plan for the past year, and it started off, they got a couple out to us, then it stopped, and after 2 months we wondered what had happened, so we rang up and they said, oh, sorry, someone forgot about it. So they said, all right, we'll get it started. So they sent us another one, and that was in July, and we have not received a financial statement since then in an accessible format. So it just shows you that even organisations that should be very aware of this need can fall behind, and, you know, these things happen, so you've got to be very, you know, on the job, make sure that these services are delivered as required. They're not doing you a favour, it's in the documents. And it's required. So
that's a good point to close on, because it emphasises the need for everyone to learn as much as you can about these systems, and when things go wrong, talk to the people you know who are having experiences, and talk to advocacy organisations like Blind Citizens Australia and others, just to make sure you're as strong as you can be in getting the case for what you need up. I'm going to hand over to John now, who had some very important news, and that would be about lunch.
Thanks, Leah. And the point I just want to make in reference to that last point is I remind everyone in the room and those listening that, of course, under the Disability Discrimination Act, there are specific provisions about access to government laws and programs. That needs to be tested with the NDIA very soon.